Tēnā koutou katoa. Ngā mihi ki a koutou e whai ana te mātauranga ki ngā pātaka kōrero o Tāmaki Makaurau. Nau mai ki tō mātou ko ngā ipurangi. Ko James Aho. I'm your friendly neighbourhood librarian based at the Auckland Central Branch, and this is the Auckland Libraries podcast. This episode was recorded at the Auckland Central Library on the 12th of February 2017. Called Tino Rangatira Tanga Today, the workshop spent the day breaking down the concept and what it guides us to do today. The first section is a short panel discussion between Emi Rākiri, Kingi Snelga, and Moana Jackson, and an introduction to the themes around Tino Rangatira Tanga.
Is what does Tino Rangatira Tanga mean to you?
Tino Rangatira Tanga means to me the ability to be Māori, essentially to the right and the privilege to be Māori. And Moana talked a little bit about the idea of honesty, and I think that's key, is to be honest about our history and not shy away from that and don't accept anything different to what is the truth. Whether the messaging from our treaty partner is different, that doesn't matter because the truth is the reality and that Tino Rangatira Tanga has never changed and will not change. So that's pretty much where I am. It's about acknowledging our own sovereignty and not worrying about what our treaty partner might think.
What are some of the issues today that shape the struggle for Mana Motuhake?
Oh, if I can just touch on two issues that I think are emblematic or symptomatic of the struggle, apart from the broader issue of the powerlessness of our people. One of them, I'm sure Em could talk about much more knowledgeably than me, but that's the current state of imprisonment, the incarceration of Māori men and women, which is a long-term colonising ploy. Prisons were introduced in this country as a tool of oppression. And so one of the major issues that I think is important is the exercise of rangatiratanga would necessarily not include prisons. The whole idea of prisons is actually, in my view, anathema to tino rangatiratanga. It is contrary to tikanga. It does not mean that if people harm others, they should be allowed to escape the consequences of that harm that they have caused, but there are other ways, more effective, more humane ways of dealing with that, more tikanga-based ways, really. And the second is symbolised not far from here, at Ihu Mātau. the colonising machinery is like a sort of ever-hungry monster that wants to take more and more. And I don't know if you saw it when you leave, you might like to look in one of the display cases out there. There's a little poster from the late 1850s in England encouraging immigrants to New Zealand with the promise of 40 acres of free land. Well, we know whose land it was. And most of it's been taken, and they're still not content and still seek to take more. And so Ihu Mātau is just one example of the struggle to hold on to what little land is left. Because it seems to me that the word tangata whenua only has substance if you have whenua to be tangata upon. And if the Crown through its corporate agents, continues to just take our land, then at some stage, the very essence of who it is to be Māori comes under threat. So those are just two, I think, of many issues, really.
Yeah, so prisons is a big thing that my group does a lot of work to try to destroy. So I think Moana really nailed it just then, so I won't bang on about it again other than to tūsoko what he said. I think it's really important to think about the function that these things play, so they don't... I think there's a kind of misunderstanding of racism that can occur sometimes, which is really important to address. And it's the reality is that Captain Cook didn't sit in England and kind of think of a brown person in his head and go, oh, I hate those guys. I'm gonna like go find some. We're gonna fill up a boat, put in a bunch of supplies in the boat, and go off and find a brown person and just really fuck up his day. Like that did not occur, and that would be an insane thing to think. But I feel like a lot of our understandings of racism kind of hinge on this idea that colonialism happened here, the theft of Māori land happened here because white people hate us. And they certainly might. But the reality of what happened, the reality of what drove capitalism is that it became a historical necessity in that time period so that the capitalist mode of production could continue for more land to be found, for more raw materials to be found, and for somewhere to put all of the European working class who are now surplus to needs to be put. And, a supposedly empty land works really great for all three of those problems, because you can chuck all of your excess rowdy workers there and tell them to start farms. You can steal a bunch of stuff from whoever's around there, and that's really valuable resources. I mean, one of the things about the signing of the Te Reti Waitangi is that it gave the Crown the exclusive right to act as real estate agents, basically. And that's the outcome of the land wars, is that they confiscated a bunch of land and then sold it very, very lucratively. So when we talk about the problems in our society, yes, interpersonal racism is a very, very real, very hurtful, very unpleasant thing to go through. But the drivers of the racism that has destroyed Māori society and forced generations of us into poverty is not interpersonal racism, but a historically necessary set of conditions under capitalism. And until we deal with those underlying political, economic demands of capitalism, that system will never go away. So I think that capitalism is real bad.
I agree with those comments. And just wanted to mention one other thing, I guess related to the legacy of what capitalism has done to us, but to not forget our own individual tino rangatiratanga, that it's a tough world out there to be Māori, and for many people in our whānau, they might want to be engaged, but they don't know how to. So to make sure that we don't forget to keep engaging our own people, because that is who we are, and we need them to not forget that legacy and that history for why they might be in a difficult place right now. So I think that's equally just as important to achieve mana motu hake, is to look after our own, look after the people in this room that are working really hard, but also bring people with you so that when we do achieve mana motu hake, that it is for everyone and everyone understands it.
Next up, we'll hear more from Moana Jackson. Moana has worked internationally on Indigenous issues, including the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. He also co-founded and continues to direct Ngā Kai Whakamārama I Ngā Ture, the Māori Legal Service. Listen to him unpack tino rangatiratanga as an Indigenous conception of power.
I usually ask organisers of hui, but no one's ever done it. Have you seen when rock singers go on stage and they have those wraparound mics? I'd love to have one of those one day. You know, I can pretend I'm Bruce Springsteen or something. The first question was, what is tēnā rangi tiritanga? And what I think is happening with a concept like rangi tiritanga is a bit like the notion of racism. People in this country generally don't talk about racism. It's become a dirty word. And if it's talked about at all, it's abstracted. It's become an abstraction which removes it from the reality within which racism operates, and more fundamentally, removes it from the hurt, the pain that racism causes. And so the recent incident, which I'm sure you've heard of the young woman who was approached by the mad butcher and who told her that Waiheke Island was now white man's land. And she then went, as young people do, went on social media and was really upset. Because the racism in that comment is hurtful. What was interesting, though, was the responses from white people who did not acknowledge the hurt. Instead, they made comments, oh, that might have been a racist comment, but he's not a racist. Hello? You only make racist comments if you're a racist. And then some attacked her for seeking her 15 minutes of fame. Well, that was a particularly callous racist response. Racism is not an abstraction. It's an ideology, a way of seeing the world, which underpins colonization. Colonization, by its nature, is a racist process. It's where countries in Europe, white countries, assumed they had the right to dispossess people outside Europe who were not white. So colonization is fundamentally racist, and racism is not an abstraction. And the moment you make it an abstraction, it becomes very difficult to understand, in my view, not just its origins, but the pain that it causes. Now, in a different context, I think tēnā rangi tiritanga has been abstracted. It's been lawyerized. It's been captured by lawyers and politicians who have removed it from the reality within which it was defined and exercised. And I'd like it, if I might, just to do a little thing on the whiteboard. Because tēnā rangi tiritanga is a complex idea, but it's only complex because all notions of political power are complex. But its actual meaning is very, very simple. Tēnā rangi tiritanga is what I call the Māori concept of power. Every human society realizes very early on in its history that it can't live in a power vacuum. That communities, when they come together, need to find some way of establishing the basic values, the basic norms, the ways within which they will live together as a community. And so every community develops a concept of power. And those concepts are culturally defined, so that the concept of power developed and understood in Western Europe is called sovereignty. That's the word that was developed in Europe to describe how people in Europe will make decisions in its most poetic form, will determine their own destiny. But the concept of power was defined quite differently in China, in Japan, and here in Aotearoa. The notion of power, the way in which people can live together as a community, is culturally defined. And so tino ranga tiratanga is just the latest variant of the Māori concept of power, which was originally called mana. And tino ranga tiratanga is actually quite a recent word, what linguists call a neologism. It's actually quite a recent descriptor of that concept of power. And o tino ranga tiratanga means as a concept of power is that iwi and hapū have the authority to determine their own destiny, to make decisions for themselves. So that tūhoe made decisions for tūhoe. Ngāti Whātua made decisions for Ngāti Whātua. Just as in Europe, France made decisions for France. England made decisions for England. And the making of those decisions, the determining of that destiny, is mana o tino ranga tiratanga. So the actual underpinning idea is very, very simple. It's just that Māori can determine Māori destiny. How that might be acted out, how that might have been played out, will differ from time to time. And if we take this side of the whiteboard as the time when our people first arrived in this land, and as you know, every iwi and hapū has a waka tradition, so we don't set a date, we don't say Māori arrived in 1400 or 1356 or whatever. We say our people arrived on the waka takitumu, on the waka horauta or whatever, and we trace that through whakapapa. So this is that arrival time, and this time is 2017. The side of the whiteboard is 2017. So tino ranga tiratanga, mana as a concept of power, was developed over a long, 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 long period of time. In 1840, is here. And what makes tino ranga tiratanga complex in 2017 is that in this tiny piece of time, it has been constantly defined and redefined by the people who came here in 1840. And they have overlaid it with their European concept of power called sovereignty. And they have reduced rangatiratanga to something subservient to that sovereignty. But the mana of tūhoe was never subservient to the mana of Waikato. Just as the sovereignty of England would never be presumed to be subservient to the sovereignty of France. Because in its simplest term, that concept of power is an expression of independence. It is the right, the hope of people to be independent. And so I think it's always helpful that if we're asked to discuss what is tino ranga tiratanga, we don't see it as something that began in 1840. As one speaker in one of the groups said, if we know the words, then we get a clearer understanding of its meaning. And the words originated a long time before 1840. Alongside concepts of power, every culture develops what I call sites of power. That is the place where you give effect to your independence, the place where you give life to your concept of power. so that in the United Kingdom, the site of sovereignty is Parliament. And Parliament is a culturally defined site of power. But every culture, every community, just as it develops its own concept of power, so it develops its own place where that power is exercised. And the difficulty we get into, and I'll come on to the difficulty shortly, is that since 1840, both that concept and that site of power, as I said, have been swallowed up in a foreign and imported, a fundamentally oppressive notion of power that is called sovereignty. But for me, the idea that a polity, that a community makes its own decisions is really, really simple. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? I'd like to do a little exercise, which I know some of you have seen. So if you could just be with me, it might just explain why I think we do get into difficulties about the notion of rangatiratanga, and why we get into difficulties on the 6th of February every year. And why Waitangi in the north has so often become a source of conflict rather than a place of recognising what actually occurred in 1840. It has been co-opted by the overarching sovereignty of the Crown, because that is what the Crown has done with the treaty. So, if you've seen this before, please just bear with me. See, Major Naran is our people in that long period of time prior to 1840. And these two chairs represent our land. Okay, do you want to put your feet up? And in 1840, we exercised the power of tino rangatiratanga everywhere in this land. We were the boss, okay? We were independent. And it's good to be independent. It's good to be the boss. Sometimes it can be problematic. I'm one of 10 children, and my older brothers and that are much older than me, and they got married, had children, and then started to have grandchildren. And I noticed a real change came when they started to have grandchildren. Because if one of the mokopuna, particularly for granddaughter, was born, my brothers would turn to jelly. They would become hopeless. The granddaughter would say, jump koro, and my brothers would say, yes dear, how high? And I used to say, I will never be like that. I will never be like that. I will remain my own boss. Well, I now have 7 girl mokopuna and only 1 boy. And my whānau delight in telling me that I'm worse than all of them. And I used to deny it until one day when my oldest mokopuna was 4 and my boy told me a story that she'd come home from Kohamareo and had misbehaved. Well, I stopped listening at that point because I knew she never misbehaved. And she was reprimanded by her mother. And Tila said, but I do that at Kohanga and Nanny says it's all right. And her mother said, well, at Kohanga, Nanny is the boss. But here at home in this house, Mama and Papa are the boss. And my beautiful little 4-year-old mokopuna thought for a while, looked up at her mother and said, well, that's all right. You can be the boss in this house because I'm the boss over in Kuru's house. It's good to be the boss. And so we were the boss. And we were the boss not of a Māori political entity, but of an iwi and hapu political identity. Any of you do geography? You recognize this? That's our place. I'll just get the geography of Ngāti Kahumanu right. And this common landmass was made up of different, what I call, mana houses. Okay. So there was a Ngāpuhi mana house, a Ngāti Porou mana house, a Ngāti Kahumanu mana house, and so on. Just like, you recognize that part of the world? What's that part?
Europe.
That's Europe, right? Just as in Europe, there were different, what we would call, sovereignty houses. Okay. The sovereignty house of France, sovereignty house of Austria, sovereignty house of Italy, and so on. All of those houses had their own concept of power and exercised their independence within their house. And so we were the boss in each of these houses in every corner of the country. Then about here, about 1770, people started to come from somewhere else. And they wouldn't accept that we were the boss. They were part of what I call the culture of colonization, where people from Europe presumed they could go anywhere in the world and be the boss. And so our people began to have problems with these newcomers and try to find who their boss was. And from 1815, our people began writing letters, because we learned the technology of writing really quickly, began writing letters to London, because we had found out that the boss of these people was something called the Crown in London. And so we wrote to the Crown and said, we are the boss in our land, and your people aren't accepting that we are the boss. I'm sure that if someone from England went to France, they would accept the jurisdiction of France. If they went to Italy, they would accept the jurisdiction of France. But because we were deemed to be brown, savage, and inferior, they would not accept our jurisdiction. So finally, after a lot of thought, our people agreed that perhaps we should do what we've always done when there are issues that need resolving. We should treat with these people. Perhaps the bosses should make a treaty. And so, in 1840, can I borrow you?
Oh, okay. 5 minutes.
We found the boss. So this is Queen Victoria. Would you like to bathe? And we said, you are welcome to come and you can share this land. And we will treat with you. And we will treat because we have our own Boston, if you like. And we recognize that you are a boss too. And so anyone who comes here after 1840 will come as what we now call tangata tiriti. They will come as immigrant settlers, accepting that this one would be the boss, but this one here would continue to set the jurisdiction and retain its own being the boss. So whether you came from England, can I borrow you? Would you like to stand behind the Queen? If you came from Russia, can I borrow you? Would you like to stand behind the Queen? And where are you from? Where's your family? Okay, if you come from Japan, no, straight line. Stand. Okay. And so the treaty then was a very, I think, aspirational, imaginative, but sourced in the absolute political reality of this country, that you are allowed to come. We will even let you, excuse me, we will even let you have a crown house, okay? And the challenge is, how do we make this relationship work? How will Te Norangatira continue to express the independence of Māori in this new relationship? Well, because of colonisation, of course, and because these people thought there should only be one boss, they said to our people, "E tu, we are now one people, you must come and stand in line, normally the back of the line. You can put your feet up there." And so now we will be the boss, not just in the house the treaty gives us, but in every house. And so you Māori will no longer be independent. You will be subject to us. And I've always found that a really, apart from dishonest, racist and so on, a really magical presumption. Because where for hundreds of years, there's nowhere in our history, as I said, where Kahumunu would wake up one morning and say, "I don't want to be the boss in Kahumunu anymore. We'll go and ask Ngāti Porou to make Kahumunu decisions." Just like the Queen of England never woke up one morning and said, "I don't want to be sovereign in England anymore. I'll go and ask the Emperor of France to be the boss in England." It's not a human reality. But what we've been taught to believe is that on the 6th of February 1840, every Māori in the country woke up and said, "Don't want to be the boss anymore. We'll ask that fat lady in London we don't even know to be our boss." That is such a magical suspension of disbelief that it amazes me how people still believe it. And what it has done, it has abstracted the notion of Te Norangatira. It has defined it as something less than what it is. It has redefined it so that Māori in the last few years have been moved to the front of the line because they are tangata whanua. And as tangata whanua, they will have a special partnership with the crown. But the crown's still the boss. And so Te Norangatiratanga has been abstracted into a management role subject to the bossdom of the crown. That's what's made it a complex issue in 2017. But its underlying philosophy is really simple and deeply human, that every human harbours within themselves the desire to be independent and be free. And the challenge of the treaty is still in 2017, that one day we will be back here. That in political, constitutional, social, economic terms, we will again be our boss. That doesn't mean these people cease having a right to be here, but the terms on which they are here go back to what they were meant to be in 1840. Is that clear? Kei te marama? Thank you. Thank you. So the second question was, how is Te Tiriti o Waitangi relevant? It's relevant because it's the base on which everyone, no matter where they come from, who have come here as immigrants are here. It was the first Immigration Act, if you like. So it cannot be dismissed, it cannot be redefined as something lesser than what it was. It was a generous offer by our people to others to share this land. But there were conditions attached to the sharing. So its relevance today is it remains the base of what this country should be. Muri, you see yourself and your communities in the story of Te Noranga Tiritanga. Can I answer that by talking about a sports broadcaster you may have heard of, who a few years ago was charged with assaulting his partner? You know who I'm talking about?
Yes.
Broke her back and so on. Went to court and was given community service. Now, the work I do in other areas, around prisons and so on, I'm absolutely sure that if that sports broadcaster was Māori, he would have been sent to jail. But he was white, he was rich, and he wasn't. After the trial, he made a public statement, which was self-serving, self-excusing, and basically, in my view, painted himself as the victim. And he was rightly criticised for that. And then last year, he issued another public statement, which was even more self-serving, which even more re-victimised the victim. And again, he was brought to task. And that was around about the time that my mokopuna put me on Facebook. Are you all on Facebook? And I never go on Facebook unless one of my mokopuna sends me a text, oh, we put up another photo or something, then I'll go on. Well, around about the time that the journalist made his latest statement, I got a text from one of my moko to go and have a look at some new photos. So I went on, and there were about 20 comments by women, I thought quite reasonably challenging what this man had said. And as I read through the comments, as I, what's it called, scrolling, is it? You're scrolling down? As I was scrolling down, I was looking for a comment from a man. That's a woman, that's a woman, that's a woman, that's a woman. And then after about 20 women, I hit the first man, who did not criticise, did not challenge the sports journalist, but challenged the woman. And then there were about 30 comments from other men, the most vile, sexist, hate-filled comments, actually, against women. There was not a single man who owned the issue and challenged the journalist. Well, I don't know how to put messages on Facebook. So I went online, I found his email. So I sent him an email. I thought it was a really sensitive and caring email. Told him he was a prick, basically. In a sensitive and caring way. I got a really obscene four-word response. But I like to tell this story because what's the relevance of the treaty is that no matter where your family have come from to live in this land, you have to own the treaty. Just as men have to own the issue of violence against women, everyone in this country has to own the treaty. It's not just a Māori thing. And we will own it in different ways. So if my whānau have come from China, how does my community respond to and own that relationship where Māori independence again becomes a reality? If my whānau came from Wales, how do we acknowledge that relationship? How do I become part of that relationship? Do I simply sit in the Crown House and enjoy the benefits that have been stolen from Māori? Or do I work within my particular house to help address what colonisation was and is? So again, for me, the issue of what is the treaty in relation to my community is quite a simple one as well. And part of that, if I can just say, one of the difficulties we get into is that one of the things about the colonisation of the world's indigenous peoples that happened after 1492 when Columbus stumbled into the Caribbean was that white people presumed they could go anywhere. The world was their oyster. Whether it was India, Malaysia, Kenya, South Africa, wherever, they could go there, ignore the jurisdiction of the people who were there, and say, this is mine. And so if we're going to work as our communities within a meaningful, honest treaty relationship, then one of the things that we all have to do is know our place. And that if you're a Pākehā, it's not just your right to bowl somewhere, into somewhere, unless you are asked. Because to assume you can just go where you like is a very colonising presumption. It's like walking into a house where you don't know the people, but you think you have a right just to walk in, which is what colonisers do. They walked into the house of India and just said, this is now my house. So being part of that community trying to relate to the treaty means being really careful about the place that we occupy, the space that we choose to make our own. And it's my experience, and certainly our history, that our people have been very welcoming and accommodating to others. But the accommodation is always dependent upon certain kawa or rules, is always dependent, if you like, upon an invitation. And the final question was, if you wake up tomorrow and Te Tiriti o Waitangi was honoured, what would it be? There's a really amazing publication. If you want to go online and type in Mā Tike Mai, I'll write it on the board. Those who don't know, but there are some I know here who were involved, Mā Tike Mai was a group set up at a national Māori hui in 2011. There were over 3,000 people at the hui, and the hui was on Māori development. And at the end of the first day, I wasn't there on the first day, but the end of the first day, Tumu Te Huihui, the Rangatira of Ngāti Tūwharetoa, did something which he often doesn't do. He stood and spoke publicly. Normally people speak on his behalf. We know they're speaking his words, but they deliver it for him. But he apparently stood up and spoke and said, well, it's the first day of a three-day hui on Māori development, and we spent the whole day talking about the Crown. And so he suggested that the hui remember some work that his father, Hepi Te Huihu, had done in the mid-1990s, when he said it's time to begin a new conversation about constitutional transformation. So the 3,000 participants at the hui discussed that night, and they decided to set up a working group on constitutional transformation. I arrived at the hui the next day and found that in my absence I'd been elected chair of the working group, which is an interesting constitutional way of making decisions. But the reason for setting up the working group was because the current site of power, the current concept of power that was brought here by the Crown is not the concept of power that was envisaged in the treaty, because it subordinates Māori. It diminishes rangatiratanga. So our working group travelled around the country for 5 years, asking people a really simple question. If you could change the way this country makes decisions tomorrow, based on te tiri te o waitangi, what would it look like? And that required first that we no longer accept the Crown view that Māori gave away sovereignty, voluntarily agreed to go and stand at the back of the line. And after 5 years and 252 interviews, 252 hui interviews and various other things, the report was released on Waitangi Day last year. And so if I could wake up tomorrow and Te Tiri Te O Waitangi was being implemented, then one way in which it would be implemented would be in a constitutional process where Māori could again make decisions and Māori jurisdiction would underpin what happens in this land. A number of people in the first group I sat in expressed dissatisfaction with what happened at Waitangi this year, where the intent for many years at Waitangi has been to talk the treaty, talk colonisation, removing colonisation and so on. And a few years ago I stopped going to Waitangi every Pākehā election year, because you had flaunting politicians who arrive every 3 years and then you never see them again. And the whole dynamic of the day gets changed into a reaffirmation of the concept and site of power. And I'll probably go back next year, and I bet there's only about 1/5 of the politicians there, which means it will be a much better But I wanted to acknowledge that, because if the discussion about the Treaty of Waitangi on Waitangi Day is going to mean anything, then it has to be a discussion about what the treaty actually said, not an occasion for politicians to pontificate about how good they are or how offended they are for not allowed to speak or whatever. And the final comment in regard to that I'd like to make is the election this year. Some of you look old enough to remember. In 1990, there was a big Māori, what was called a protest movement, which adopted the slogan, "Don't vote, it only encourages them." And that strategy was developed not so much to stop people voting in an election, but to ask people, what is an election about? Whose power are we talking about? And what has that power got to do with the Treaty of Waitangi? And many, many years after 1990, those still seem to me to be the important questions to ask. So can I close finally with one more story about my mokopuna? People know I like talking about my mokopuna. Any of you know whakatāne at all? At the heads of whakatāne, in the sea on a little rock, there's a statue of a young girl standing like this. leaning into the wind off the waves. And our people say it's Wairaka, the tipuna who, when a storm came up, brought the Mātātua waka safely to shore. And we were at the Heads one day, and my mukus were playing in the shallows. And the 7-year-old jumped on the rock and said, "Kura, look, that was." And then when we left, I exercised my Kura Good Health Initiative and took them to McDonald's. And she was playing in the playground at the top of the slide. She said, "Look, Kura." We got home and she ran into her mother. "Look, Mum." And that night, we were lying on the bed talking, and I just asked her, you like Wairaka, eh? And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Why do you like Wairaka?" And she said, "Because she was brave." And she certainly was. And I said, "Yes, she was certainly brave. Anything else you like?" And she jumped up on the bed and she went like this, "Because she was free. Because she was free." And what Tino Rangatiratanga means is not the freedom of Māori to have decisions made by somebody else, but the freedom of Māori to make decisions for ourselves and to do that within the framework of the treaty relationship. So I'm sorry I've gone over time. I hope that was of some help. Kia ora.
This episode was produced by me, James Stutley. The music is by Fruit Juice Parade. You can like, follow, and subscribe to Auckland Libraries on social media. Ka kite.